Blog Talk Radio.
Well, welcome, Americans. What history can teach us about overcoming the present. I'm Dave Balog. I'm the author, and this is our series of songs from the book. And we think you'll be interested in knowing about the people who both made America and harmed America. And today we have an interesting look at Walter O'Malley, the man who changed America's pastime into a cold business. So we're going to read about Walter O'Malley and then talk about the book and where you can get a copy. Thank you for listening, and here we go. It was a crime against a community of people. It was Branch Rickey with Robert Rieger in The American Diamond, a documentary of the game of baseball by Simon & Schuster, New York, in 1965. Success. The boys of summer had appeared in 5 World Series, losing every time to the New York Yankees, until breaking that streak and winning the championship in 1958. However, as exhilarated and relieved as the Brooklynites were, Rio was heading their way. Team owner Walter O'Malley was demanding a new stadium to replace cramped, decaying Ebbets Field, the team's home since 1913. O'Malley had a plan for a new stadium in Brooklyn, which he said he would build and fund entirely himself. What he wanted from Robert Moses, New York's all-powerful commissioner of everything, was help in assembling the land at a particular site in downtown Brooklyn. Moses, however, would not use the power of eminent domain to clear the land for O'Malley, usually the most expensive part of such a project. At a World Series game in Brooklyn in 1955, O'Malley got a direct overture from an unexpected source, the city of Los Angeles. That city was courting O'Malley and his team. As much as Brooklynites had delighted in their Dodgers' success, an increasing feeling of dread began to spread in 1956 and 1957 as O'Malley operated at his most obsequious regarding the team's future. He was riding 2 horses in different directions, playing the city of New York versus Los Angeles. Dick Young, the esteemed New York Daily News sports reporter, began his story on the Dodgers' first home game of 1956, thusly. Inching their way out west, the Dodgers today opened their season and raised their championship banner in Jersey City. O'Malley had arranged to move 7 Dodger home games to New Jersey in both 1956 and 1957. Writer Herb Ross, in the film The Ghosts of Flatbush, said that with all of O'Malley's hints and maneuvers, even with this going on, it was unthinkable that they would ever leave, that it would ever happen. It just couldn't happen. But they left us. They left us. There's a bitterness that's never going to go away because they left us. Evitz in 1957 was Walter O'Malley, the former team attorney who had made his first fortune as a bankruptcy lawyer during the Great Depression. He had become the Dodgers' attorney when the team went bankrupt. O'Malley positioned himself into a share of ownership. Over the years, O'Malley outmaneuvered Branch Rickey, his main rival in team management, into sole ownership. He was now, more than anyone, seen as the one arsenal Dodgers out of Brooklyn. Multiple meetings with Mayor Wagner of New York City and even testimony before a congressional hearing proved fruitless in keeping the Dodgers in Brooklyn. O'Malley also teased and tortured Los Angeles politicians throughout 1956 and 1957. Stadium site, while refusing commitment to relocate. Finally, after the city council approved ceding 300 acres of prime real estate for a Los Angeles Dodger stadium, O'Malley made the deal. In October 1957, just 2 years after winning their first championship, their first and only championship, the Brooklyn Dodgers sent an anonymous public relations employee to the Los Angeles territory. Walter O'Malley was not there. That day, he was again the invisible man. He didn't seem to be anywhere. The move had all seemed inevitable. The final game in Brooklyn fell on a Tuesday night, September 26, 1957. Dodger pitcher Clem Labine said, "It was like visiting a dying friend in the hospital. Everyone was trying to be brave. There weren't a lot of people there, maybe 6,000, but there were more tears than you could shake a stick at. The players stayed to chat and sign autographs. We felt really badly for the fans." Ebbets Field organist Gladys Gooding settled on the keyboard. She played a German song titled "Don't Ask Me Why I'm Leaving." Brooklyn had a professional team since 1884. It was beyond sad. This was the era when the mere mention of Brooklyn on radio, in the movie theater, or on TV would elicit hoots, laughter, and applause. 1947 was the year Jackie Robinson broke in and courageously broke baseball's color line that had allowed only white players to play the national pastime. Robinson showed more courage than all the bigots who tried to make him fail. Jackie was not at the last game in Brooklyn. Despised by O'Malley for his civil rights activism, Robinson had been traded the previous season to the hated rival New York Giants of all teams. He promptly retired. Decades later, in an interview in Los Angeles, ironically aired back to New York, Dodger broadcaster Vin Scully dismissed the emotions of the last game in Brooklyn. He insinuated that Gladys Gooding, the organist, was an alcoholic and drinking that night, and that once she played Auld Lang Syne, it was all downhill from there, he said. Unlike the players, Scully was oddly unemotional about moving the team. And why not? O'Malley had surprised him with an offer to move along with the team out west. Scully thought that O'Malley would naturally want to hire established local Los Angeles broadcasters. But on opening day, 1958, the Dodgers in Los Angeles, at the microphones were the Brooklyn duo of Scully and Jerry Doggett. Scully was especially of two minds regarding the business aspects of the move. O'Malley had to leave. He had no choice, said America's broadcaster. On the other hand, Scully said once that O'Malley's deal with Los Angeles was the biggest land grab since the Louisiana Purchase. The Dodgers and the Giants were preeminent founding members of organized professional baseball. As author David Cort wrote in The Nation in the summer of 1957, while not as important as nuclear fallout or housing, millions of people in New York and around the country indeed felt as though they had been irradiated or evicted by the loss of both teams. That New York did lose both of these teams by the 1958 season painfully exposed the reality that the sport of baseball was really the business of baseball, a bond between fan and player, fan and team, fan and sport, was harmed irrevocably. The Dodgers were owned by Walter O'Malley, who in his new home, Los Angeles, Hollywood, could certainly have been sent from central casting to play a villain for practically any movie. His defenders argued, and argue today, that like The Godfather, it was only business, not personal, for O'Malley. Sportscaster Howard Cosell said that while Los Angeles deserved a team, taking the Dodgers from Brooklyn wasn't necessary. They could have gotten another team. Carl Erskine said, with great insight, of the fans left behind, if you were a member of the Dodgers board of directors at the time, you would have thought that Walter O'Malley was a genius to see the possibilities of Los Angeles, move the team, and that he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. You can't convince that to a Brooklyn fan, and I don't ever try. Public pain at the loss of the Dodgers in 1957 has been difficult. Robert Caro, noted historian, said that it was the first time many people truly felt that trusted public figures were capable of such deception. Former Dodger broadcaster Barber called owner Walter O'Malley the most devious man he had ever known. One commentator asked if any Brooklyn fan had ever had a solid night's sleep after the move. In a thoughtful but little note, Peter, who inherited the team after his father's death, returned the 1955 championship banner to the borough of Brooklyn on the 40th anniversary of the victory. In a ceremony at the Brooklyn Public Library, very near the site of Ebbets Field, now torn down for city apartments, the younger O'Malley generously said that the flag belonged in the place where it was won. Well, we'll take a quick break and come back and tell you more about the book. Well, we want to share a comment on our book, The 20 Worst Americans, What History Can Teach Us About Overcoming the Present. Author and historian David Bannon has written this. At first glance, David Balog's The 20 Worst Americans may seem to be a simple laundry list of villainy, but this is no tirade of personal grievances, nor is it a whining screed against those who think differently than the author. Instead, Balog has called upon his background in history writing to present the citizens whose behavior he sees as particularly heinous: Harvey Weinstein, Paul Castellano, ignorant Phyllis Schlafly, Eddie Seacott, Betsy DeVos, vicious Dan White, Rupert Murdoch, or simple grifters, Henry Ford, Charles Cobb, and Donald Trump. There are 20 short essays in all. Each is easy to read, pleasantly brief, but never glib or lightweight. Balog has something to say, and he says it plainly. Balog calls upon an encyclopedic knowledge of history to make his points, which he does not hide behind manipulative propaganda. No, we know where the author stands, and he is transparent in his views. What surprises us is his gentle tact while discussing subjects that could infuriate readers if presented by a lesser writer, and that is David Bannon, author and historian. Well, you can get your copy and start reading for free if you visit Amazon.com. You can search by my name, David Balog, B-A-L-O-G, or easier, we've set up a website, 20worst.blogspot.com. That's 20worst.blogspot.com, and we'll put it in the description for this episode. Well, that's it for now. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.